baseball players dream of. He has the second highest batting average in the National League and had been named MVP of this year's All-Star Game. But the dream turned into a nightmare when he tested positive for testosterone. In a statement, Cabrera apologized to his teammates, the San Francisco Giants organization, and to the fans. The Giants are currently tied with the Los Angeles Dodgers for the National League West lead, thanks in large part to Cabrera's performance this year. His 50-game suspension will carry over into the postseason if the Giants reach the playoffs. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
U.S. men's soccer is celebrating its first win at Mexico in history, a 1-0 win last night. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at subaruofchampaign.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In the late 2000s, the Ford Motor Company was definitely running on empty. The company was just hemorrhaging cash, and people were worried about its continued survival. In fact, at one point, the Ford family considered the possibility of taking the company private. And of course, you will recall that Congress did offer a financial bailout to two other big automakers, GM and Chrysler. They took the money, but Ford decided it would save itself. And the company did it, in large part, really by pulling together. A lot of people contributed to the big turnaround at Ford, but there was one person that was really the leader in all of this, and that is Alan Mulally, the man who was then and is now the CEO of the company. It turned out that when Ford brought him in from Boeing, turned out that was a very good hire, because by the beginning of 2010, it was clear that Ford had pulled off one of the most amazing turnarounds in American business history. We will be getting that story this morning in this hour of Focus. And our guest is Bryce Hoffman. He is an award-winning journalist who has covered the auto industry both in the U.S. and around the world since 1998. He began covering Ford for the Detroit News in 2005, put him in a position to write the book that we'll be talking about here this morning. The title of his book is American Icon, the subtitle Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. Crown Business is the publisher. It's an interesting story. And Bryce Hoffman, hello.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So you covered Ford for the paper, the Detroit News, for a number of years. Was that your full-time beat, just covering Ford?
It was. You know, this is Detroit, and we have auto industry is so big here that we have dedicated reporters for each of the domestic automakers.
Well, that's what I wondered. So there was a GM person and there was a Chrysler person?
That's right. We have someone who covers the foreign automakers as well, who covers regulatory affairs in Washington. It's kind of a big deal here in Detroit.
Well, understandably so. So the way this came about was that you had watched these things and you decided maybe there was a book in this, and you actually went to Ford and said, "I want to write this book." You took the time off to do it, and you said to the people there at Ford, "I really want you to be able to speak freely." So, with the exception of significant on-record interviews you did with Mulally, you talked to all of the people that you talked to, and you talked to a lot of people. You talked to them on background.
That's right. It just was a way, because most of the people who I was talking to for this book were active employees of Ford Motor Company, or, you know, suppliers that still provided parts to Ford Motor Company, bankers that still finance Ford Motor Company, and it was just easier for everybody to speak freely if they had some level of anonymity. It just seemed like the best way to kind of get at the real truth of the story.
And just for the record, we're completely independent of Ford. They didn't have any. They didn't review that. You said, "Look, I'm going to write the book. I'm going to write," and they did not interfere with that in any way.
They did not, and that was the deal we had going in. Not that they didn't ask, you know, at the end, you know, "Can we see it?" And I said no, but you know, the way that this came about was, you know, this arrangement was I went to Bill Ford and I went to Alan Mulally, and I knew both gentlemen well, and have developed a level of trust with them. And I said, look, you know, I'm going to write this book. We know how the Ford story ends right now. It's a fundamentally positive story. But I think it's going to be more powerful if I can tell the whole story, if you kind of will let me inside the company and see what really happened. And, you know, for me to do that and to do it justice, I need to be completely independent. So, you know, what I promised them was fairness. And what I got in return was access. Hmm.
So you think in terms of, say, American business history, this chapter in the Ford story that you're talking about here really stands out?
I do. I think it's one of the greatest turnaround stories in business history, globally even. Hmm. I mean, here is a company that and the full magnitude of Ford's problems really wasn't known outside the company until this book came out. They were really on the verge of bankruptcy in 2006. They were actively talking about parting the company out to other automakers. There was private equity firms kind of circling Dearborn like vultures. They briefly looked at the Ford family taking it private again. I mean, they were really running out of road. And at the time, you know, everyone in Wall Street was telling me this is the company that's going to fail first. But instead of failing, Ford fixed its problems, and it did it itself without taking a taxpayer bailout at a time when the rest of the automobile industry collapsed, died on the operating table, and was only revived by a massive infusion of public capital.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the, and I'm sure that all of the big automakers had similar kinds of problems, but I think one of the points that you try to make here is that there were some significant ways in which Ford was different from GM and Chrysler.
That's absolutely correct. You know, all of the Detroit automakers, you know, had been ceding market share for decades to the Japanese and other foreign competitors who were just building better cars than they were and were doing it more cost effectively. All three automakers had these were kind of hamstrung by these union contracts that had been negotiated in better times that had created just really inflated labor costs that were completely out of whack with what their foreign companies were having to pay to build cars in this country. They all had, you know, these same issues, but Ford had a lot of cultural issues that really go back to the early days of the company. It had always had one of the most poisonous corporate cultures. People really, you know, there was a lot of infighting. People put the advancement of their own careers ahead of the success of the company. I'll give you just one example. There was a small car that was developed in Asia that had a lot of potential. And the head of the Asia-Pacific group at Ford was a rival of the head of the Americas group. So he ordered the engineers to design the car in such a way that it could never be sold in the U.S. because it wouldn't meet U.S. federal guidelines, just to deprive his rival of this, you know, kind of ace in his portfolio. And that type of thing happened all the time at Ford. So it was not a company that was just competing against GM and Toyota. It was a company that was competing against itself.
Yeah, there's this odd sense in which it was so many separate parts. There was the Europe division, there was the Asia division, there was North America, and even within those, I'm sure that there was infighting, and there was never seemed not really a sense that we're maybe not until Alan Mulally came along, not really the sense that we are all one company.
Exactly, and that was one of the biggest things that he did right away was to kind of come up with this concept of one Ford, to take the company's really vast and impressive global resources that had kind of been, you know, split and fractionalized and bring them together as one global corporation that could compete with the best in the world and win. That's really what he did.
Just very quickly, I want to introduce again the guest, Bryce Hoffman. He's an award-winning business journalist who has spent a lot of his time covering the auto industry, both here in the U.S. and around the world. And he is the author of a recent book about the big turnaround that happened in the late 2000s at the Ford Motor Company. The title of his book is American Icon, and it's published by Crown Business. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So in the early 2000s, from 2001 until 2006, the company was being run by Bill Ford, who was the great-grandson of Henry. And by 2006, the company was having all these problems, and Bill Ford knew that he wasn't going to be able to solve them. Certainly, he wasn't going to be able to deal with all the problems of Ford's corporate culture. So he stepped aside. He was persuaded to step aside, however. I'm not exactly sure whether that was his idea. How difficult was that for him?
You know, this is such a macho industry, and the idea of a senior executive, let alone someone whose name is on the side of the building, stepping aside from running a company day to day was just unheard of in this town. So it really was a big move by Bill to do that. You know, it's one that he came through some difficulty. You know, he really wanted to fix things himself. He did know what was wrong with the company. He tried to fix it, but he just at the end of the day couldn't do it. And you know, the board kind of persuaded him that the best way to do this, you know, to give one more chance to saving the company was to bring in someone to run the company day to day, to have the ultimate authority over the day to day operations of the company, who'd done it before, who'd turned a company around. And that's the amazing thing about Alan Mulally. Ford is not the first American company he saved. He famously turned Boeing around after the September 11th terror attacks, which almost bankrupted the aircraft manufacturer.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about Bill Ford and all of the responsibility that he carried in addition to carrying the family name. He certainly wanted to do the best for the company. He apparently, it's this very emotional board meeting, which now I'm sure a lot of people still remember. This was the meeting where he famously said, "Look, I have a lot invested in this company, but my ego is not part of that."
And, exactly.
And that seemed to be, really did seem to be a sincere expression of how he felt.
I think it's very sincere. You know, like I say, I think it was a difficult decision for him to come to, but it was one that he made genuinely, and he deserves a huge amount of credit for doing, because really it allowed the door to be open for someone who could really do the kind of, you know, radical surgery that was required to save Ford Motor Company.
So before bringing in Mulally to talk with him about being a part of the company, they went and started to look at some of the biggest name CEOs in the automotive business around the world. And they set their sights pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, for several years, actually. I mean, Bill knew that he needed help. And so he had been actively trying to recruit, you know, the kind of big name CEOs in the auto world, guys like Carlos Ghosn, the head of Renault and Nissan, who at the time was a real rock star in the auto industry. Later, Dieter Zetsche, who many of your listeners may remember from commercials as Dr. Z, the German head of Chrysler when it was owned by Daimler. And he was really, you know, spurned by both of these guys. I mean, Ghosn was willing to come, but only basically if Bill Ford just stepped away completely and let him run the company without any input from the family, which was not going to happen. You know, these guys were not willing to come to Dearborn unless they could basically have the company to themselves, and even then they thought it was a risk. Mulally, you know, is a guy who is passionate about American manufacturing. He really sees his mission in life as kind of reproving to the world that America can still make things and make them profitably, and provide jobs in this country and abroad in manufacturing. And he had done that at Boeing, and he saw this as another opportunity to prove that he could do it, you know, in another industry.
Well, this was controversial. It certainly, at least within the company, it was a controversial choice, because people looked at Mulally and said, "Well, this guy doesn't know any. What's this guy know about building cars?" He had to prove himself and went on, as you've explained, to be very successful. But what was it that got Bill Ford even thinking about Alan Mulally as a possible CEO?
Well, you know, when Bill finally, you know, made the decision to step aside, they knew by that point that no one in the auto industry that they wanted was interested in coming to run the company. And so the board members opened their Rolodexes, and the name that popped to the top of the list immediately was Alan Mulally's, because even though his name was not a household word at that point, he was very well known in business circles as the guy who'd save Boeing. You know, the board and Bill both agreed that this was the type of person they needed, somebody who had done it, who had been through the fire and come out, you know, unscathed, successful, who could talk to the employees and say, "Look, I know it's hard, but I know it can be done because I've done it before." That was key, because there was a lot of people in Dearborn by that point. People's morale was so low that they really weren't, you know, in a state of mind to just kind of rally themselves. If someone came in and said, hey, you know, I think we can fix our problems, most people kind of would have just rolled their eyes because they'd heard that before and it hadn't worked. But Mullally was able to come in and say, I know we can fix our problems because I've done it at a company that was just as bad off.
We have a caller here. We'll bring into the conversation again. Our guest this morning is journalist Bryce Hoffman. He is the author of a book, American Icon. It's about the turnaround that happened at the Ford Motor Company in the late 2000s. And questions welcome. And we'll just get right to the first person here. And that's someone in Savoy. And it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'd like for you to talk about, you know, Lincoln and Mercury because, you know, I know a lot of people lament, the, you know, the passing of Mercury because, you know, they had some, you know, some a fine lineup of vehicles. And also, I guess from what I've been reading, Ford is kind of in a quandary what to do about, you know, position Lincoln because, you know, they're kind of, you know, playing second to, or third fiddle to all the other luxury brands like Lexus, BMW, and Cadillac. I'll hang up and listen, but before I do, I'd like to say, goodbye, David. We'll miss you, and I hope they name a street or a building after you.
Well, we'll see if we can do something about that. Hey, thanks very much. Well, what do you think, Bryce?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. I mean, the question of what to do about Mercury and Lincoln was very central to Mullally's strategy. And Mullally's strategy was all about streamlining Ford. He had, you know, he had been at Boeing, and Boeing sold Boeing planes all over the world. They didn't have a bunch of sub-brands. And when Allen arrived in Dearborn, in addition to Lincoln and Mercury, Ford had Volvo, they had Mazda, they had Jaguar, they had Land Rover. And he made one of his top priorities getting rid of all these foreign brands because, A, he wanted to free up capital to fix Ford, but just as importantly, if not more importantly, he wanted to keep his executives from being distracted by these other brands and focus on fixing the Blue Oval. That was job one for him. And and he saw Mercury and Lincoln as a bit of a distraction too. He decided early on that he wanted to just pare the company back down to Ford. So they looked, you know, at getting rid of Mercury very quickly, which was a bit of a controversial decision because Mercury was bringing some customers to the brand that weren't really looking at Ford, particularly, you know, younger women and other demographics. But Mercury's were really just Fords with a different grill put on them. So the question was it really worth doing? And Allen wanted to simplify things, so they decided to get rid of Mercury. He was persuaded to keep Lincoln a bit reluctantly because he wasn't sure, convinced that they needed a luxury brand, but other executives said, you know, look, we can't be a real automaker without a luxury brand. And right now they're kind of making one last, you know, big push to save Lincoln. They're spending over $1 billion to refresh Lincoln right now, but I think the jury is still out on to whether that will be successful.
That's an interesting, this move that Ford had made to acquire all of these prestige brands like Rover and Jaguar. And I think some people looked at that and wondered really what the point was. I'm not sure that that did much for the company. I think that in the case of Volvo, I think some people thought actually that the quality of the automobiles declined after Ford bought the company. And I'm not sure about the others, but what was it that Ford management at the time thought buying all those companies was going to do for them?
Well, you know, David, you hit the nail on the head. It was prestige. You know, it made Ford a global player at the upper echelon of the automobile industry. It gave Ford an entree into the kind of rarefied atmosphere that was occupied only by companies like Aston Martin, which I forgot to list that they own too. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was something that people like Jack Nasser, who had been CEO before Bill Ford famously ousted him, you know, valued. And it was a huge drain on Ford's resources. I mean, you know, Jaguar was just kind of like a pit that they threw money into. It never came close to turning a profit when they owned it. And, you know, Land Rover, on the other hand, was quite profitable. There were some years when Land Rover was the source of all positive cash flow inside Ford, if you will. But net-net, most of these brands were losing money. Mazda was a big exception. Mazda was gave Ford a window into Japanese manufacturing, into the Japanese automobile industry, that really allowed Ford to kind of develop some really world-class automobile platforms based on what they learned from Mazda.
Hmm. We have another caller here. Let's talk with them. Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I had a question. Two issues. One is I've read the book, and I found it very interesting and learned a lot that I didn't know about the behind the scenes. I compliment you on doing a really thorough review.
Thank you.
My question was, how would you compare Mullally with Lee Iacocca and Chrysler? And then the other issue is, it seemed to me that I've been reading that it's a good chance that Mazda is going to go under because Ford sold off most of their parts of it. And, in fact, they haven't found a suitor, and so bigger is better in the automobile industry, which is sort of too bad because Mazda makes really nice cars and, as you said, really gave Ford a winner with the Fusion and the small car lines. So it's kind of sad that here's a really good company might go under just because of the way things are going, you know. I'll ring off and listen to your comments.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Good book.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book. Those are excellent questions, and I'm a huge Mazda fan, too, and I have good news. I think Mazda has found a suitor in Sergio Marchionne, the chairman and CEO of the Fiat Chrysler Group, recently announced a product development agreement with Mazda. I think it's going to be the beginning of a much deeper alliance between those three companies, and I think it's just the thing that Mazda needs to stay in the game. Lee Iacocca, obviously one of the great auto industry executives of history, but I think there's a lot of difference between Iacocca's management style and Mullally's. Iacocca was a very intelligent, very strategically minded executive who knew how to get Chrysler back on track. He wasn't so much about building teams and changing the culture in a way that could kind of sustain that success. And we saw Chrysler, after he departed, kind of go back into its bad behaviors and then ultimately end up going bankrupt. Mullally is not just about fixing Ford's problems today. His system of management is about changing the way the company functions. And I think that if Ford adheres to his methods after he leaves, Ford will continue on the path to success and continue to be profitable, continue to be a strong company. I think that's the big difference. It's about, kind of just, the king versus the coach, if you will.
Mm. Well, that's, I think, one of the things that really emerges here very clearly is that in his personality, in his personal style, the way that he worked, the way that he related to people, that Alan Mullally was very different from a lot of other CEOs. He certainly didn't act like a big-time CEO. And it must have been early on that for some of the other top management people there in Ford, this was kind of strange.
It was very early on. It was noted on his first day in Dearborn. Alan doesn't like to wear suits. He doesn't wear suits. And he showed up for his first day on the job wearing a blazer and slacks and a tie. Dearborn was still a fairly button-down place where if you were an executive, at least, you certainly wore a suit to work every day. And when he had his first meeting where Bill Ford introduced him to the senior executives of the company, a lot of them rolled their eyes at this guy walking in dressed in their mind so casually. He ruffled feathers in terms of that kind of casual style from the start. I know that, Mark Fields told me that Mark Fields is Ford's president of the Americas. When he heard that Alan had been hired as the new CEO, he went on Google or found a video on YouTube of Alan celebrating the launch of the 777 jetliner. And Alan, when the plane passed one of its major stress tests, the video showed Alan grabbing one of the other senior executives and giving him a big bear hug. And Fields was like, wow, that's going to be different.
People at Ford weren't into hugging one another.
They were more into driving knives into each other's rib cages. So that was definitely a change, and it's amazing to see how it has kind of changed the culture there. You walk down the corridors of the 12th floor of Ford World Headquarters, where the senior executives are now, and you see people, stopping and saying, "Hey, how'd your kid's football game go this weekend?" and things like that. This is a company where 6 or 7 years ago, they wouldn't even walk down the same hall together. One of them would have ducked into an office to get out of the other's way, so they didn't have to even make eye contact.
Yeah. Well, you know, you explained about the fact that when they went looking for a new CEO, they started with the people that were in the industry.
Yeah.
And when that didn't pan out, they started to look outside. And very quickly, Mulally's name rose to the top because he had been so successful at Boeing. So Bill Ford brings him into Michigan, and the two of them meet. And it seems like those two guys clicked, and that Mulally got very excited about the challenge because he knew just how bad things were there at Ford. So he got the job. So clearly, Bill Ford thought that Mulally was the right guy for the job. I think, though, that also early on, there was a lot of friction between Mulally and some other members of the Ford family.
Well, it wasn't so much members of, I think what you're getting at, and it was significant, was Bill Ford's chief of staff was his brother-in-law, Steve Hamp. And you know, Mulally, just on principle, didn't even want a chief of staff. He looked at the organization chart before he even accepted the job, and he crossed that position out because he said, look, I don't want to insulate myself from my management team. I want them to come to me and tell me directly what's going on. But he also didn't like the idea of the chairman's brother-in-law, you know, kind of looking over his shoulder. So, you know, Steve Hamp left the company very early on. The amazing thing about Mulally's, you know, kind of revolution at Ford, though, is how few people did leave the company. I mean, our paper, you know, ran a column the day after he, you know, was hired, basically, within a few weeks after he was hired, you know, saying, you know, when are the heads going to start to roll? Because, you know, in this town, when a new guy took over, he usually cleaned house, and there was a lot of people who felt that Ford really needed some house cleaning. Mulally told us from day one, you know, I don't think that's necessary. I think that the people here have the skills to save the company. They're just not using them. They're more worried about fighting for their turf instead of saving the company. And I think if I can get them focused on saving the company instead of, you know, fighting for their careers, that we can do all right. And he said, you know, there will be a few people, as he put it, who will self-select out of the equation. And he was right. There were a few people who decided that Mulally's kind of warm and fuzzy management style was not for them, and they left. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Bryce Hoffman. He's the author of the recent book, American Icon. It's about the turnaround that happened at Ford in the late 2000s. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Starting September 4th, Focus is live once again. WILL AM 580's interactive talk program features hour-long conversations about politics, the economy, healthcare, education, the environment, and many more important issues and ideas affecting your life. I'm Craig Cohen. Join me and join the conversation as Focus is back with new live shows weekday mornings at 10, starting Tuesday, September 4th on WILL AM 580. You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Bryce Hoffman. He's an award-winning journalist who has covered the auto industry, both the American auto industry and the industry around the world. He's been doing that since 1998. And starting in 2005, he began covering Ford Motor Company for the Detroit News. And that put him in a position to get to know a lot of people in Ford. And he used some of that knowledge and a lot of conversations that he had with people at Ford to write the book, American Icon. The subtitle is Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. Crown Business is the publisher. Well, as you explained, that maybe a couple of major things that Mulally did, partly things changed because of who he was, but he also took on this problem of the corporate culture of Ford. And one of the things that he did, and it seems on the face of it to be kind of simple, but apparently this turned out to be very important, was that he instituted a weekly meeting where all the managers came in and they sat around a table. And what they were supposed to do was to essentially talk about what they were doing and particularly to talk about problems, things that needed to be fixed. But the problem was, at the start, nobody wanted to admit there were any problems.
Exactly. And, you know, it's kind of funny because it does seem simple. You know, here's you know, this company that is really fighting for its life. And, you know, Mullally's response, you know, externally, the first thing that we saw was this announcement that there were going to be these weekly meetings. And I know one of my colleagues at another publication kind of mockingly wrote a story under the headline, Ford's Big Idea, A Better Meeting. And it did seem a bit laughable, but, you know, it's amazing how much it changed the company, because Ford was a company that couldn't tell itself the truth. Every time people were asked to present data about their part of the company executives, they used different data sets for different audiences. If they wanted to convince, if an executive wanted to convince the finance people to green light a product, they might inflate how many they expected to sell enormously in order to make it look like a good value proposition for the company. If they wanted to make sure that the manufacturing people didn't throw a fit, they might deflate it. Mullally forced everybody to sit around a big round table and share the same set of data and do it every week and not blame each other for problems, not congratulate themselves for their successes, but just take a dispassionate look at where the company was and how much progress it was or was not making towards its turnaround goals. And all of the data was presented in a color-coded format so everybody could clearly see if there were problems. If things were okay, they were displayed in green. If there was a potential problem, they were displayed in yellow. And if there was a real problem, they were displayed in red. This is a system Mullally had developed at Boeing and had used it very successfully there. And, you know, he taught the Ford executives how it worked and started the meetings a few weeks after he came to Dearborn. And he sat through the first several meetings, and everybody was putting their slides up, and everything was green. And after a couple weeks of this, he just cut somebody off in the middle of their presentation because he'd had enough. And he said, you know, guys, We're about to lose more than $14 billion. Is there something that's not working at this company? And everybody just stared at him. Because at Ford in the past, if you admitted you had a problem in your division, that was just like throwing chum in the water for the sharks to go after you. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to admit that they had a problem. But the next week, Mark Fields, the president of Ford's Americas Group, knew that he was going to have to delay the launch of the Ford Edge, a new crossover the company was about to launch. And he had it still listed in green on his charts, even though he knew there was a problem with it, because that's how things were done at Ford before. But he decided that he wasn't sure he was going to keep his job anyway under Mullally. And so he decided to see if Mullally really meant what he said when he said he wanted to know the truth. So he changed it to red. And in his presentation the next week, he got up and he got to the slide about products, and he pointed to the line that was red, and he said, for the Ford Edge, we have come up with a problem that we're looking into, and we're going to delay the launch, and as you can see, it's red. There was dead silence in the room. And I've talked with all of the executives who were sitting at that table, and every one of them told me that they were sure that Mark Fields had just fired himself from Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. Instead, somebody started clapping. And everybody looked, and it was Mullally. He was sitting at the center of the table, clapping. And he said, Mark, that's great. Who can help Mark with his problem? And people's jaws literally dropped because it was so different from how things had worked at Ford in the past. But the funny thing is, you might think, well, the next week everybody was going to come back with their actual data. But instead, everybody thought that Mark probably had been fired over the succeeding 7 days, and they just hadn't heard about it. And when he walked into the room the next Thursday and was still the president of the Americas, it was only then that people realized that Mullally was serious. And the week after that, as he put it to me in his own words, it was a rainbow.
Well, Mullally felt that particular meeting, that one where Mark Field said, okay, here we have a problem, was a big turning point for the company.
And it was. And the meeting 2 weeks later where everybody's charts kind of looked like a crime scene, there was so much red splattered all over them, that was the point that he really decided that he could save Ford Motor Company. He said that he wanted to go home and cry. but he said, you know, at least the people, it was kind of like dealing with a room full of alcoholics. At least he'd got them to admit that they had a problem.
Yeah.
Now he could get them to start talking about how to fix the problem.
And apparently now this guy that we're talking about, Mark Fields, a lot of people think that he is the he's the leading contender for CEO if when the day comes that Mulally decides to step aside.
That's right. That's right.
I want to just make sure that people listening know, that are listening to Bryce Hoffman. He's a journalist, business journalist, has spent a lot of time writing about the auto industry, Ford Motor Company in particular, and he's the author of a recent book. The title is American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. Crown Business is the publisher. We have about 14 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I think that here, clearly in the story, Alan Mulally is a very important figure. Clearly, also, a lot of other people had to step up, or else he couldn't have done this by himself. And I think that maybe there must have been, at around the time that we're talking about, the feeling, the understanding in the company that this was very likely their very last chance.
It was, and that really helped Mulally's case. And once, a couple months after he arrived, Ford took out what he likes to refer to as the biggest home improvement loan in history. They borrowed more than $23 billion, and they had to put the entire company up as collateral, including the Ford name, including the Blue Oval. And that really, you know, was valuable for two reasons. One, it gave Ford more capital than say, GM to weather the storm that was about to hit the automobile industry. But two, it really drove home the point to everybody in the building that this was the last chance, because if Ford didn't make good on those loans, there was going to be no more Ford Motor Company. The banks were going to take it. They were going to sell the Blue Oval to some Chinese automaker so that they could sell their cars in the U.S. and try to fool people into thinking they were Fords. It was going to be game over, and everybody knew it at that point. Everybody knew this was the last chance.
Now, and people will, of course, recall at this point that all of the automakers, American automakers, were all in trouble. In Washington, there was great concern about what would happen to the economy if they should fail. And so assistance was provided, which to this day is probably controversial. Was the Ford management surprised at all by the action of the Obama administration to step in and rescue the industry?
No, they weren't surprised. In fact, they were lobbying vociferously for it. Mulally made it very clear that Ford needed GM and Chrysler not to fail, because all of these automakers depend on each other, on the same set of suppliers, to provide the parts that their cars are made of. And if GM in particular had failed, it threatened to bring down the entire automobile industry in the United States, certainly potentially worldwide. And so Mulally, Ford initially joined GM and Chrysler in asking for federal aid, but when they went to Washington and just got pilloried by lawmakers, Mulally came back and said to his team, you know what? We're fixing our problems. They aren't. We need to make a break with these guys, and the best way to do that is to do the right thing and stop asking for money. Stop asking the American people to fix our problems. You know, we should fix them ourselves. We can do it. It's going to be tough, but let's withdraw our request for aid. They did that, but he still went back to Washington with GM and Chrysler to kind of, bolster their request for aid on behalf of the entire industry. And he's even gone on record as recently as this week as saying that it was the right thing to do. That said, once the federal government took over GM and Chrysler, Ford had some real rude awakenings in how things were going to go competing against companies that were owned by Uncle Sam. I'll give you just one example. Ford and GM had both been fighting a whole host of class action lawsuits for years, stemming from the use of asbestos and brake linings back in the 1970s. They had an agreement that had been longstanding to jointly defend all these cases and share the legal cost and share the settlement cost. Well, shortly after the federal government took over General Motors, their corporate counsel called Ford and said, hey, we just wanted to let you know you guys are on your own now with this asbestos stuff. Ford said, what do you mean? We're both dealing with this together. And they said, no, we're no longer responsible for this. The federal government says that we no longer have liability for this. And Ford was just dumbfounded, because here their arch rival was being just relieved with the stroke of a pen of hundreds of millions of dollars in liability that Ford was now going to have to contend with on its own.
Yeah. Something else that you know, there's some of what you write about in the book, other people have written about it. It you know, people other than maybe the internal workings of the company, what happened in the behind closed doors. But there is something that's really interesting that you do write about in this book. This was again in the late 2000s when the economy was in such bad shape, and they were struggling, and the people they were doing business with were struggling. Ford got together with Toyota and Honda and worked together to try to support the people who supplied them with parts, because they knew that, you know, if that fell apart, well, then they were going to be in big trouble.
You're absolutely right. And this was one of the biggest revelations to me as someone who had closely followed all of this. Nobody knew about this. In fact, I just last night was at an event with one of the lawyers who was involved in this for one of the suppliers, and he told me that his jaw dropped when he got to the point in my book where I talked about this, because he thought this was going to be remain secret till everybody died type of thing. And this is, you know, Mullally's, you know, strategy of working as a together extended outside Ford Motor Company, and when the entire supply base was threatened with collapse because the suppliers were actually in worse shape than the automakers, Ford reached out to its arch rivals and said, hey, you guys depend on the same companies we do. Let's work together and make sure that the ones that are critical to all of us stay in business. And they asked General Motors to participate in this, and General Motors turned them down. They thought it was a violation of antitrust laws. They asked Chrysler to participate in this, but Chrysler was falling apart so rapidly at this point that, you know, they would make an appointment to talk to someone from Chrysler's purchasing department and call back the next day and find out that they were no longer employed. And Nissan also, to a limited degree, participated in this. But this was really a case of, you know, recognizing that everyone was in this together, and that the best way to deal with it was to work together to kind of, you know, make sure that the companies that everybody was most dependent on stayed in business. So they did a lot of horse trading, and you know, they would do things like, you know, say, well, you know, look, you know, this company provides lights to us. They're critical. They need some more business. If you give them some light, you know, business, we'll give some business to this company that provides, you know, wheels to you that's also struggling, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
And I think that makes an important point, that for those people who said or still say, oh, well, the government should have let them, if they were going to go under, just should have let them go under. I mean, not only would you be talking about a big company like GM, for example, and all of the people that worked for GM and all of the ways that it penetrated the American economy, but you'd also be talking about all of the suppliers that the company worked with and the ripples that would have gone out in the economy if GM would have collapsed would have been devastating.
Oh, they would. And it wasn't just Ford that saw the importance of this. You know, I'll tell you, in 2009, spring of 2009, when all of this was happening, I was in Japan for several weeks, and I met with the head of the Ministry of Trade and Industry in Japan, and he wanted to know whether the U.S. government was going to bail out General Motors. And I asked him what he thought of that, and his exact answer to me was, we feel that this is a gross violation of the World Trade Organization treaty, and we fully support it.
Well, just going back to you made the point about how Toyota, Honda, Ford were to some more limited extent, Nissan were working together to make sure that their parts suppliers would survive, and that they said to GM, "Do you want to take part in this?" GM said, "No, we don't want to have anything to do with this because we think this might be illegal." Well, apparently the companies that were involved, their lawyers were on this every second to make sure that nothing illegal did happen. So clearly they were worried about that there was a fine line that they were walking in, and they were worried about the possibility they would step over.
Exactly. And Ford had its antitrust attorneys sitting in on every phone call, you know, which were, these were daily occurrences at this point. You know, and it was a little bit, you know, dicey because, you know, the Japanese have a different view of these things. You know, their economy is structured in a way that the government, you know, plays a bigger role, and the companies are allowed to kind of help each other out. So they, you know, a lot of times, it's, you know, Ford's lawyers had to kind of step in and say, well, you know, hey, you know, that sounds great, but we can't do that here, mm-hmm. you know.
We have another caller here, about 5 minutes left. This is someone who is in Champaign, and line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I go back to the Ford, you know, the Crown Vics and all those, and when Ford meant, what, fix or repair daily, you know, in terms of quality control. In terms of quality control, was it Toyota that did, in other words, they tracked their vendors, and so, in other words, they could fix their problem quicker, that kind of thing? What about the quality control? Why is Chrysler still having problems with quality control?
Well, you know, quality is a huge part of the equation and a big reason why Ford was able to come back. You know, Ford, even before Mullally came, was already really making, you know, quality a real priority again, and he really accelerated that effort. And, you know, within a matter of a few years, you know, by 2007, 2008, you know, publications like Consumer Reports were rating Ford's vehicles as equal to or better than Toyota's in terms of quality. The Ford team just knew that getting it right was going to be critical. And you're right, the way that they did it was really taking, several pages out of Toyota's playbook was part of it. Really kind of working with the suppliers to do it, you know, to improve the quality on their end. But there was also, you know, Ford also had some of its own best practices that were implemented. Benny Fowler is the head of Ford's quality operations globally. And, you know, he had already come up with some really good ideas on how to fix Ford's quality problems before Mullally arrived, but because of this infighting, he wasn't able to implement them outside the U.S., really. Mullally just kind of cleared the road for him to tackle the quality issues and really kind of make it job one for real. But you're right, it's a problem for other automakers still to this day. Chrysler's quality is improving, but they're coming from the very bottom of the barrel. So in the most recent, for instance, J.D. Power and Associates initial quality study, they improved 6.6%, which was above the industry average of 5%, but they're still in the bottom tier because they're coming from, you know, pretty much dead last.
So we talked about what a remarkable turnaround this was, and it certainly was. We wouldn't, however, want to give people the impression that, you know, the record of management is perfect over the last few years. And you spent a lot of time talking to Mullally. Did you ask him anything like, okay, now tell me where you really think you screwed up?
Well, you know, he's not the type of person who's going to tell you that they screwed up, because he's, you know, one of his principal jobs he sees for himself is kind of being cheerleader in chief. But I think that Ford has had some missteps, and I think that the most notable one involves its SYNC technology, it's my Ford Touch technology, which are kind of these cutting edge, you know, in-car communications and infotainment systems that they have added to their vehicles in an attempt to really kind of leap ahead of the competition, and particularly to connect with younger consumers who really value technology in products. It was a smart idea, and they've had a lot of success in attracting younger buyers to the brand with these, but these technologies are, you know, in some cases, you know, proving a little bit difficult for some consumers to use. They're having, you know, problems with some of the development of these. And, you know, these are not things like, you know, engines breaking or door handles coming off. It really comes down to ease of use with these technologies. And some analysts are saying that Ford just has tried to go too far too fast with them.
So Alan Mullally has been the CEO since 2006.
Correct.
Right? And so how much longer do you think he's going to be in the job?
Well, that's the million or billion dollar question. And, you know, I think that he recently accomplished, you know, I think the last major hurdle of his turnaround just was cleared, and that was paying off those loans to the extent and getting the credit rating up to the point where Ford could take the blue oval out of Hawk. The company is no longer mortgaged. And that was kind of, you know, a very big kind of, like, you know, final period on his turnaround strategy success. But, you know, I think that he's still concerned about some of the company's, you know, trajectories. Particularly Europe has become a challenge for all automakers. Ford was late to the game in Asia and is still trying to catch up there, and you have these issues with SYNC that we were just talking about. So I think that he would like to see the company on a more, you know, stable footing even than it is now. But, you know, I do think that he is getting, you know, he's past the standard retirement age, and, you know, I think that, you know, I think that the really final proof point of his turnaround strategy success will be if Ford can continue to succeed after he leaves.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're down to having about a minute left. Clearly, Ford, there was a dramatic turnaround here. GM, while they required federal help, GM came through it and survived. Still maybe some questions about Chrysler. Overall, what could you say about where the American auto industry stands today?
I think that the industry is obviously, you know, it's made it through this near-death experience. Ford is a very solid company. The issues that we're talking about are the issues that any business deals with, you know, as it goes forward. They're not existential crises. I actually think that Chrysler's in some ways in better shape than GM because they have, I think, a clearer vision of where they're going and how to connect with the American car buyers. They've just been gobbling up market share, much of it at the expense of GM, some of it at the expense of Ford in the past year. You know, GM is the biggest of the big three, and I think that they are, you know, they have also survived this near-death experience, but I think that they're still trying to kind of find their way forward.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. Our guest, Bryce Hoffman, he is a journalist who has quite a lot of experience covering the auto industry since 2005. He's covered the industry for the Detroit News, not only in this country, but also around the world, and he's won a lot of awards for his work. And if you're interested in reading the Ford story, you should look for his book, American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. Crown Business is the publisher. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Real privilege.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
Support comes from Wesley Church and Wesley Foundation at Green and Goodwin. Free Connect gatherings and dinner for new grad students, faculty, and community members with information on area resources held August 17th. Worship services Sunday at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. Details at wesleyui.org.
I'm sorry, Frank, but I can't agree to let you risk another burglary.
Look, the library was strictly a smash-and-grab job.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Frank Langella. He's starring in the new futuristic film Robot and Frank, about a retired burglar with dementia whose caregiver is a robot. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where it is very much a mixed affair at the midpoint of the trading day, with wheat showing strength basically on news out of Strategic Grains, estimating that perhaps in the Black Sea area they will have less wheat to export than the Russian government has suggested previously, and lowering those estimates somewhere between 12 and 13 million metric tons of export, and Russia had previously suggested a number more along the lines of 16 million metric tons. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat, 872 and three quarters, up 14 and three quarters. December, 898, up 15. March of 13, 908 and a quarter, up 13 and a quarter. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 865 and three quarters, up 19. December, 885 and a quarter, up 19. And March, 892 and three quarters, up 16 and three quarters. September corn, 798 and a quarter, up four and a quarter. December, 808 up four. March of 13, 807 and a quarter, up three. May, 799 up three quarters. July, 786 and a quarter, down one and a quarter. September soybean meal, 1662 and a half.